Session number 16712, Albert Sketchard, Reel 11.
Reel 11. You were telling me the story of the German soldier killing the Australian.
Correct your luck. He wasn't a German soldier, it was a German civilian. As I said, all the postings, that's the sentries, had disappeared somehow. So we think it was a pre-arranged job, because the Australian could speak fluent German, and he had been made the go-between, the Germans and the English can interpreter, exactly. And anyway, it shot him, and there was nothing we could do about it. And when he shot him, we rushed forward. And we just got a caught underneath him, and we knew it was no good then, because he was really on his way out, and Patty died within about 5 minutes. And everybody stopped work and refused to do any more. Sentries came from all over the place, and marched back up to the camp, what we had. And there was a Corporal Dalglish there at the time, and Scottish bloke. He said, "Right," he said, "that's a finish." He said, "There's no more civilians to be anywhere near us. When we go to work, we want sentries with us all the time, and an inquiry into this." So he said, no work. So the Germans came next morning, and the sentries, a pair outside, roll call, went out for roll call. And then what you had to do then was you had to go in, get your coats or whatever gear you wanted for work. But we went into the huts and we stopped there, and the German sentries came, and they were shouting and threatening. But anyway, we stood past them. We told them exactly why we wouldn't go down until we got a senior officer. Well, it was a senior officer came and got us all out on parade. And there was nobody went to work anyway that day, and he gave us like the 3 days off, like, say, his funeral and everything.
Did you know the name of the Australian?
Yes, I've had contact with him, Ralph Devlin. He belonged to New South Wales. That's where he belonged. And because I've had the letters from his parents. Because I sent them exactly a letter on what happened and everything, you see. And how he met his death and everything, because we were there, I was actually there. And it was definitely murder, like, no, there were no two ways about it.
Did anything come of this, war crimes or anything?
Yes, I believe there was, yes. Apparently, they were holding somebody who they thought was responsible for it in this village where we're at, and the Americans were holding them, in fact. And as I said, we were getting
Yes, you were talking about the fact that you were refusing to move.
We put on parade, and the senior officer came, and spoke to us, said he's very sorry about the episode that occurred, you know, 3 days before and everything, like, you know, and they said the person responsible punished and all that, like, you know. But we got assurances that the guards would be with us all the time while we're working, and no civilians would be in charge of any prisoner of war. And the next morning, there was the three of us that was left, because four of us had gone into that camp together. The three of us that had gone into that camp, we were told we've got to be separated. They must have thought we were troublemaking all over, like, you know. So, about 3 o'clock in the morning, about an hour before roll call, they got us up and they took us down to the station. Well, we'd given the camp sergeant, who was in charge of us then, he gives our name and address and everything, like, and the Red Cross number to contact, and to get in touch with them and let them know where we're getting to.
How long had you been in this particular camp?
We'd only been in about 6 months, I think, been in this particular camp.
And your accommodation in the second camp, the one that we're talking about, was where was that?
Well, it was in huts with a big stove in and everything like that. You know, just only German barracks and 3 tier bunks in it.
Very much the same as what
almost
you've been
almost the
before.
Same as the initial camp we went to. Right?
And,
anyway,
the same routine.
Same routine, exactly. Then we went, as I say, we took out of this camp early morning, and we put onto the train, and the first one up was this lad called Jimmy Stewart from Castle, and we noted the place where he got up, like, and wrote it down, and we sent it into Red Cross later on, like. And then this other lad got up, and a lad called Phillips from Wolverhampton, but I've had contact with him and all. And then I was the last one up, and it was on side of the Elm, just on side of the Elm, and went into this camp. And actually, they did me a favour because it was a beautiful player. Gets in. And up into the marched up this big hill to a village right on the top. And there was a mixture of prisoners in there. There was New Zealanders, Australians, English, and all sorts. They were all put in for some reason or another. And anyway, said welcome and, you know, and all that business. And they told us what the work was like. It was dead easy. You used to go down, you used to get you up on a morning, and roll call 6 o'clock. No, there was no 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. Roll call was at 6. And you're up, put on the wagons, and you used to go down, and you used to take you down to the edge of the forest. And your job was just, the juries used to cut the trees down, and your job was to take the branches up and clean all the trunks down. It was a big sawmills, that's all it was. And you just had to take the foliage up and everything. And you did 2 trees a day, that was your lot. And you used to go back up to the camp. Well, next to the camp there was a flour mill. Well, the Germans had a flour mill going there for their own community. Well, this lad, he saw the entrance to it, and he used to like a lift, like a hole in the ground. He used to get in there, get under, he used to bring all our flour out. And when we got the Red Cross parcels, when all the jam and everything had all went in, he used to get the coke, he used to make big, long, rolling forties, like, you know, they were beautiful. And it was quite pleasant there.
Were you again in huts, or...?
We were living in huts. It was very, very good. There was plenty of firewood, I mean, from lying about.
Was it a big camp?
It wasn't a very big camp, no. It was only a small working party, that's all it was.
And who was in charge of, British soldier, who was in charge of...
The Germans were in charge, but actually there was... was a New Zealander in there. I think he was in charge through his seniority, you see. I think he was a RSN, I think he was. And anyway, he organised things and everything went pretty well there.
If she became ill, what medical attention did you get?
Well, we used to get... there was a van used to come round about once every 3 months, what are called a delousing van. And if you merited, if the captain merited, then everybody had to get or throw all the clothes in. You used to get a gown just to put over you while the clothes are getting done, and then thrown out the other end.
Clothing, it must have been wearing your clothing. Oh, well, we got issued with
a battle dress each. We got battle dress from the Red Cross. We got them each. After being there about 12 months, we got that. One of the camps that we were issued with it.
Did the Red Cross actually come round and look at the camps to see what was happening and see that you were being treated
well? Yes, we didn't see them. We were nearly all out, you know. But reports were sent in of every camp. Obviously, otherwise they wouldn't have known anything about what was going on.
Mail from home, when did that start arriving?
Oh, the mail from home, we were getting that about once every 3 weeks or something like that. You should get through all right.
Was it censored by the Germans when you
wrote? Always all censored, yeah. They were all open when you got to mine. And then stamped down over here again, like you know where they're stamped. Because there wasn't much you could write in, you know, or put in, because it was all censored going out. In fact, what you used to get a card once a week, like a postcard like that, and you wrote your message on there, and the Germans used to check it and stamp it, and then just sent off, like, you know. That's all you could do, that's the only conversation you could have on. Keeping well, you know, things all right, and you couldn't put note of them, really.
Was the food any better at this camp than it had been the other?
Oh, yes, the food was 100% better, because everybody put all the rations in, and we were getting white flour from this mill, so this lad was baking bread. He must have been a cook and all and everything, and we would have done pretty well. And we used to trade out chocolate to the Germans down there at the workplace where we worked, because there was offices and all that down there. And the German lasses used to bring maybe half a dozen eggs in, and we used to get them the bars of chocolate for half a dozen eggs, and so it all went back up to the camp.
As well as food and cigarettes that you've mentioned in your Red Cross parcels, did they send you items and materials to, you know, to help you with your leisure, to give you things to do? Were you getting games or equipment from them?
Well, I wasn't going to get games in them.
So you were basically in small camps, weren't you? Small working parties.
Yeah, we were only small kids. Maybe they got them in the big camps, I don't know, like, but... But anyway, this camp, it was really pleasant. We enjoyed it. And then we were always coming to an end then.
What hours were you working? You say you were up at 6 o'clock for roll call. What were your hours?
Yes, we went down there at about 8 o'clock. And they got so used to it that you were allowed to walk down. One sentry would be way down in front of you, and maybe about 5 or 6 o'clock, about 200, 300 yards behind them, and just walking leisurely down the hill through the village and into the workplace, into the lumber camp. Because there was no way we could run to. I mean, we're on the wrong side of the Elbe.
So anyway, you went down at 8 o'clock.
And we were there till about 4 o'clock.
Did you have breaks during the day?
Yes, we had a break. Yes, we had a break at 10 o'clock. And we used to get German ersatz coffee. Well, made out of acorns, and we used to get that.
Did you get a lunch?
And we used to take our lunch down with us, what we had, and then we got the main meal, as I say, when we went back at night time.
Was the work heavy?
No, the work was pretty light. because it meant just the Germans were felling the trees in the forest and harnessing the horses up, bringing the trunks out, and all we had to do was lop all the branches off and used to burn them all, and two lads were occupied all the time just putting the branches onto the fire, and then the Germans used to transport the logs up into sawn machines and cut them into strips, and used to stack them all on one side for seeing them. And we used to help them, to, like, you know, to turn them over and that. And well, it was quite light work.
Were there any accidents? Anyone hurt?
No, there was no any accidents there, no. No, everything went all right, okay then.
And you see, you got reasonably close to some German civilians who were working with you.
Well, they would tell us the news exactly by then, because they had realised that the war was coming to an end, and they were on the wrong end of it, sort of style. And they got pretty friendly to finish.
Were they showing their concerns about the end of the war and what would happen, what might happen to them? Was that being shown to you?
Not really. No, not really. But
yes, they would be free. The Russians would be the nearest ones coming.
The Russians would be their nearest. Well, anyway, I'll tell you about that. We went. We woke up one morning, and while we looked around, there wasn't a sentry in sight. And we wondered why. What the hell had happened? There was no sentries nowhere. And went down. Because there was a gateway to go to the compound. Went to the gate and it was open, and there were no sentries, and so we just got our gate and went down to the village. And still no knee soldiers. And then we heard the gunfire, because we'd been hearing the gunfire for quite a while. We get closer and closer. And anyway, we went down, there were no sentries down at work or anywhere like that, so we said, well, we're going to be off, you know. So anyway, we went down past this village along the road and come to the River Elbe, and there was a bridge there. Well, the Germans were just letting their own transport over, armaments and things like that, guns and everything like that, and their own troops. And there was none of us were allowed anywhere near. Anyway, some carts came, and the horses on, and they would pull these big heavy loads. And the Germans just grabbed about a dozen of us, just put us all behind, you know, push, like, you know. And they were really great, this. And I said, well, it's one way of getting over the bridge, isn't it?
To push you onto these wagons.
Aye, so we got on behind these and push these wagons out, like, you know. Gets over the bridge, and that's just one way of getting over the Elbe. So we got over the bridge, all right, like, and we broke away from them, mingled with the crowds on the inside, like, because everybody's all milled about. And got in with some French soldiers, and we went up to the place where they had. And the next morning, we walked down this road, and it was about 7 o'clock. And we kept to the side, and where the gunfire was pretty close then. And then we heard this voice shouting, hey, where are you guys going? And the Yank stepped out from the bushes, like, and we told him, like, you know, a little prisoner was like, I said, we've had a few of you guys down. He says, just go straight down there, you know. So it goes down, like, and they had this place organized, and went in there, and got a few cigarettes off them, and a cup of coffee, and care rations, what they call care rations. We got them off them, and then they moved us down to another camp.
What date would this be?
This is 1945. It was the early part, late 1946. That's what it was. And anyway, they got us into this place and they looked after us. And they had proper delousing machine there. So cleaned all our uniforms up and cleaned all us up. Gave us a good meal. And the master's down to this, they put us on trucks, that was it. And they took us to another part of what Mustad had already organised. And gathered us all in there. And then they took us to the airfield. Of course, the war was just about over then. Took us down to an airfield and they flew us from wherever it was to Brussels. And when we got into Brussels, we went to camp there for about 3 days. And then the masters of war onto the aerodrome. And we came over and about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, went on the plane, and they flew us from there to from Brussels to Hayward's Heath, down London there, down Sussex, and we landed there, and marched up to a camp there, and from then on we just. Regular soldier duties, guards and things like that, you know, in the camp.
How were you received?
Oh, we received pretty well. Oh, yes, the Red Cross were all there, and we were very well received.
Did they debrief you and ask you what had happened to you and where you'd been, etc., etc.?
Oh, yes, we couldn't answer them questions at that time, like, you know, we got organised and properly in the camp. And then the briefings came after that.
And you hadn't been given any leave after landing in England? You hadn't been given any leave yet?
Oh, no. Given no leave. We were there about 3 or 4 weeks, and they said that we'd be given leave, and we got all cleaned up, all new uniforms and everything like that. And anyway, we were actually given leave. I got 6 weeks, and I came home. And
how were you received at home?
Oh, very well. They were all waiting for us when I got back up right. And anyway, we one leave was just the same as another. It was just a matter of drinking. That was it. And anyway, I got on there. We had the 6 weeks leave, and I went back. And we sent to Setsfield, to a camp there, and from there we told we'd be got out the army there.
So demob from there.
We said we'd demob from Setsfield, but it wasn't right because we were eventually transferred from Setsfield down to York, and we demobbed at York.
What date was this?
So this is 1946, actually, when I was demobbed. 1946, I was actually demobbed.
What was the process of demobilisation?
Well, we were put on transport, on train transport, from Setsfield down to York, big area there, and you just marched in. And your name, number, rank, battalion, years of service and everything. And you went in, you were given a record book, you got a ration card, you got a service card, a ration book, because rations were on the go then. And well, different things what you wanted, like, you know, for going back into civilian life and that. Your discharge papers and everything. You were measured as you went along. You got a hat, pinstripe suit, demob suit, shoes, everything. And by the time you got out the other end, you were fully equipped for civilian life for a short time. It was all in, the whole lot was all put in a big cardboard box. And you put back on and sent back up to wherever you wanted to be put up at. From York, if you lived in Durham, you put up at Durham Station and you made your way for yourself from there, like.
How did you settle down to civilian life after your
Well, I just settled down and, I got in, I got on with a girl, well, it's a wife now, like. I got on with a girl there from Meadowfield, and eventually married anyway. And we married on the first anniversary of BJ Day, because the war in Japan had finished then. And we got married in 1946. BJ Day, that was the first anniversary, that's right. And I got word anyway. There was a letter came in the post, and I had to get her to go up to Bradford Camp, and that was near to where I live here, like. I went up to Bradford Camp, and they fitted me out with a new uniform, new medal ribbons, everything. And I had to report down to London. I got a rail warrant. Report down to London to the Judge General Advocate down there and the War Crimes Tribunal. And anyway, I went down and I was well received down there. And the following morning, I was marched in front of the Judge General Advocate. And it was all about the Australian made shot, like, you know, in Germany, like, and there was, they picked three witnesses. One was me, it was a lot, well, the other lot I escaped with, and this other fella. A lot of the engineers, anyway, because he was very close by. And he took a statement off the three of us, and he turned around, he said, well, he says, what are you doing for the rest of the week? And I told him, I said, well, I said, I'll be just going back home, sir. And he said, would you like to stop running for the rest of the week? And I said, no, I said, I would, you know. So he gives a form, saw the paymaster, and he took us along to the New Zealand Club and accommodation there. And I stopped a week in London for I could come back up, so it was pretty good for me, like.
So you'd given them your evidence in writing, was it?
Oh, yes, I already had a statement in writing. But this is only like a verbal conversation we had.
Had you found it difficult to change from army to civilian life?
Well, as part of missing the roll calls and things like that, like, it was a pleasant surprise, believe me.
Did you have a job waiting for you when you came out of the forces?
No job at all. Anyway, when I got in, with a wife, like, I'd already started work. I'd had the choice to go to the water board, the electric board, or on the local council. Well, the local council, they offered halfpenny an hour more than what the other two were paying. So I said, I'll take that. So I went on to the local council, and I worked for them for 2 or 3 years. And as I say, I got married then. Life was pretty hard then, because the rations were on the go then. You couldn't buy suits or anything like that, really. There was nothing you could go for. In fact, the first house I was in, we were paying £4 a week rent to a fellow. He had these three houses at Crook. We paid £4 a week rent. And to furnish it, the wife knew a shopkeeper down there, Mr. Studden. That was his name, George Studden. He still had a shop on North Road, furniture shop. In fact, I've still got a bill in there, okay? What we paid for a bed, four chairs, a table, and a three-piece suite, I think it was, something like that. £17, the lot. And then, of course, there was no cash them days. We had to pay it by installments every week. And then we got that paid off while things were going pretty well at work. And we went to work one morning, and I thought to myself, "Why, we're getting pretty far here." No, in the meantime, my brother was working for the ICI down Huddersfield, and he sent a letter up and told me he'd got a job for me if I wanted it. Well, the wife, she didn't want me to go, and I said, "Well, if it's going to improve ourselves, well, I said, well, I better give it a go. There's more money." But anyway, I went down, and it wasn't my cup of tea at all. A chemical factory, and they told me there was a village just down there, the oldest inhabitant was only about 47. So I said, "It's no good bringing all the fumes in and everything like that."